Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor, and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center. And I'm joined by my partner in crime and all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Elliot, welcome back. Are you still on the Cape or where are you?
No, actually, I'm in a different watering hole. The halo that you see around me is from windows which look out on the Hudson River Valley. So I'm up in the Catskills, which is really pretty nice. So, Eric, I am really excited about this week because we're talking about an episode that you and I both experienced as teenagers. Me, a very young teenager. You, a very old teenager, I presume.
Yeah, you really know how to hurt a guy.
which turns upside down a lot of the things that we think we knew. Perhaps I thought I knew, and I'll just, if I could, just tick off one or two, and then you can formally introduce our guest. So the topic is 1968 and the presidential election, and as we'll see, a very excellent book about that subject. So a couple of the things that people tend to think they know is, one, that Lyndon Johnson bailed out of the presidential race because Eugene McCarthy did well in New Hampshire. Turns out not to be true, that they ordered a bombing halt to help Hubert Humphrey. No, not really. That Eugene McCarthy was a good guy. Actually, he turns out to be a pretty nasty guy, at least in the telling of this tale, including somebody who, though a liberal, is in some ways pretty illiberal. Richard Nixon, I think, comes off a lot better. I think one of the ideas people sometimes have as well, Richard Nixon had the Southern strategy, which brought all those racists from the South into the Republican Party. And, you know, it's a short line from there to Trump. That is profoundly not true at a number of different levels, both what he's like personally and George Wallace, who some of us will remember, who was painted, I think, fairly as somebody who traded in pretty vile racism, but who turns out to be much more complicated than that, and who, and this is just the last thing that I found absolutely fascinating, Humphrey kind of tightened the race at the very end, but it was probably by getting voters from George Wallace. So it's not that the George Wallace voters were going to Nixon. So can't wait to discuss all this with the author.
Well, all of that, Elliot, is true and more, and we'll get into it. A perfect time to be discussing this, the week of the Democratic Convention in Chicago, where the 1968 convention famously was held and led to what one commission described as a police riot, also discussed by our guest in some detail. Our guest is Luke Nichter, the James H. Kavanaugh Chair in Presidential Studies at Chapman University, professor of history there, and the author of The Year That Broke Politics, Collusion and Chaos in the Presidential Election of 1968, published by Yale University Press. Luke, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I know you began writing this book at least in your own telling, in part as an exploration of the so-called Anna Chenault affair, which occurred towards the end of the election season in the fall of 1968, when the race was tightening and when Johnson was trying to get peace talks started in Paris. And we've talked about that episode on Shield of the Republic before in the context of discussions we've had with Will Imboden about his biography of Ronald Reagan, which included a very deep dive into the so-called October surprise. We brought Will back to talk about that after Stu Eisenstadt published a piece about Ben Barnes' deathbed confession, which, you know, attempted to resurrect the October surprise. I actually was co-author of a piece in the Dispatch that kind of tried to knock that down. And in the conversations with Will, we did talk about the Anna Chenault affair, because I said, well, there was one October surprise that was in the Nixon campaign, because that's what a lot of the historiography tells you. But I want to get to that a little bit later, because I want to start, if you will, with some of the incredible relationships that drive this election. Elections are normally about domestic affairs in American politics. In 1968, people frequently will say that was, you know, the exception that proves the domestic politics rules all, because Vietnam loomed so large. And it clearly did at the beginning of the year. You had the Tet Offensive. You had what Elliot was discussing, the Gene McCarthy campaign after the Dump Johnson movement couldn't get Bobby Kennedy to run against Johnson. Gene McCarthy jumps into the race. He, quote, wins the New Hampshire primary. He actually loses the New Hampshire primary. But he has a, quote, moral victory because he came close to President Johnson, even though Johnson actually wasn't on the ballot. He got write-in vote. He won with a write-in vote. And Bobby Kennedy gets into the race. And one of the backdrops to all of this is the personal relationships among all of these, dramatis personae of this story. So Johnson and Bobby Kennedy have a terrible relationship. They hate each other. Bobby tried to talk Johnson out of accepting his brother's offer to be vice president. Johnson never forgets that. After Jack Kennedy is killed, Bobby is sort of anointed as the successor to the Kennedy family. Johnson's relationship with Gene McCarthy, I think people tend to forget, was equally complicated. In 1964, when Johnson's picking his running mate, who ends up being Hubert Humphrey, the senior senator from Minnesota, the junior senator from Minnesota, Gene McCarthy, is one of the finalists, sort of the bridesmaid of the affair, as it were. He ultimately is not selected by Johnson, although there's a lot of speculation right up to the end until McCarthy kind of takes himself out that McCarthy will be the nominee. But also, the relationship between Johnson and Humphrey, very, very complicated relationship. And the relationship, most interestingly of all, perhaps, that you describe in the book, is the relationship between Johnson and Nixon, which is one of actual respect, deep respect for one another, despite their political differences. And they manage a very careful minuet throughout the year. So could you talk about all of these relationships and how they shaped the election in 68?
Yeah, sure. Well, that's a lot to chew off on, off on the first bite. I think what I would say is, I would start by saying, most of us, when it comes to viewing politics, like me at least, it sort of views it like actors on a stage, you know, looking at it from the cheap seats, almost like a kind of kabuki theater, I'm fond of saying. And I feel like politics, in a way, is a bit like a magic show. You know, as long as no one figures out the trick, you know, the magic continues. And for me, it would be far easier to score points for one political side or another. But actually, what I'm trying to do is figure out how it really works behind the scenes. And, as right out of college, as a young person, I worked on Capitol Hill, and then I worked in the British Parliament. And I had, you know, just a few years of experience before I realized my calling in life was elsewhere, to go back and do political history, not politics in the moment. I saw enough of the behind the scenes to realize that that's a world that the public doesn't see. It's a world that writers and academics and historians don't typically see. It's a world not documented in dusty memos, you know, at the National Archives or a presidential library. And so I realized that there's times when the personal relationships are awfully important to determining the result. There can be absolutely critical in a year like 1968. So as I started, probably the thing that I'm proudest about this entire book is the fact that I had cooperation from all four sides. So Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Richard Nixon, and George Wallace, and interviewed all of the key family members, and about 85 total staffers who were still around. And as the year 2018, you know, the 50th anniversary came and went without any, which, you know, is typically a point where we look back and it's been enough time and we can sort of make sense of it and figure out what really happened. There was very little commemoration at all in 2018 of 1968, perhaps because we were more focused on our divisions at that moment, you know, during the Trump presidency. But that, you know, I felt like the stars aligned. As someone born after this period, I had a lot to learn, but that it was time for a fresh assessment written for especially a younger generation. This wasn't meant to be an 800-page doorstop like Theodore White or others who were at the convention, a blow-by-blow account. That's been done. You know, my job at making repeated trips to archives like the LBJ Library in Austin, where I was just there again a couple weeks ago, is I would say the vast majority of records that I've looked at are stamped as being declassified, I would say 2017 to 2023. You know, these are largely, you know, newly released records, and I felt like nobody was paying attention to them. So I think my mission was really to write a 50-year retrospective. What do we know? You know, what's new? How is that different than what we thought we knew, you know, the first time around, which is very much the story that I grew up learning myself. And so I was able to lay hands, fortunately, on some new records, including Billy Graham's diary and others that does document some of these personal relationships. And I realized this is an important part of the story.
So, you know, one other person I wanted to, well, first a general observation I'd like to throw out. You know, the biographical sketches are terrific. And I must say, it makes you realize, on the one hand, this is, with all their faults, and each of these men are deeply flawed, it's a formidable generation. This is the World War II generation. Many of them have had real struggles to get to where they were. You know, certainly somebody like Nixon, but really it's true of all of them. They are, in many ways, I have to say, much more serious and deeper than the current cast of politicians we're looking at. I mean, you can't help but make these comparisons and say, these are a more serious bunch of people. And then, maybe not on the other hand, but sort of what the world they're dealing with, for all that we wring our hands about the United States in 2024, my God, you know, you have Vietnam, you have the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. And I remember how utterly shocking those were. I mean, I remember my parents' reactions to those. I'm sure, Eric, you do as well. There's this, you know, there are riots. You do a wonderful job of describing what the protesters were like in Chicago, and the extent to which, yeah, I mean, there was bad police behavior, but there was horrible behavior by a lot of the demonstrators who were, you know, attacking the police and throwing feces everywhere and all kinds of stuff. So it's really a tragic and very disturbing moment for the country, and that bears some reflection. Just one little additional personality I would like to draw you out on, in addition to all the ones that Eric can walk you through, is Billy Graham. Because first, he has relations with both Johnson and Nixon. He's, as you describe him, he's really becomes a trusted intermediary. And he's very different, I think, from many of the evangelical figures that you see in contemporary politics. You know, at a time when we tend to have a certain take on what evangelicals in politics are like, he's really quite a different model, at least so it seems to me. So that's partly question, partly commentary.
Yeah, I think if I could make two quick reactions, I would say, you know, looking at those four central characters, Johnson, Humphrey, Nixon, and Wallace, you know, all four are from modest backgrounds. And I mean, they really reflected that sort of blue collar, lower middle class voter, which I think might have been decisive, you know, that year in terms of who they would put their support behind. You know, these were traditional New Deal, Fair Deal voters that Democrats won as a voting bloc, you know, every single election. And, you know, possibly the last presidential election where they were won by Democrats as a voting bloc maybe was 1964. And their votes to some degree have been up for grabs ever since. And, you know, how interesting that a populist billionaire has infiltrated them and their camp in politics much more than anyone in, you know, on both sides of the aisle, either side of the aisle, in recent memory. So I think I would make that point. And then the second one is back to the relationships, is that, you know, another thing really different about this book. And again, to me, history is not black and white. It's full of nuance and areas we can debate, we can discuss, we can, as Humphrey might say, disagree without being disagreeable. You know, what I have here is not going to be the final word. There's lots of records still opened, lots of tapes, White House tapes still closed. But one of the other, I think, innovative things that I do that goes against the grain of the literature is I really restore President Johnson to a central place in the story. And after March 31st, virtually all books treat him like a lame duck. The spotlight shifts to others, the challengers, as we've seen even in this cycle after President Biden's withdrawal from the race. And the fact, and so I make the argument that a withdrawal from the ballot is not a withdrawal from politics, that in his remaining months in office, there's an awful lot he can do, you know, to influence the choice of his successor, offer support to any of the challengers, or withhold it sometimes is also very powerful. And so I think kind of at the outset, this is sort of my the major themes of the book and kind of the way that I approach this roughly, you know, 8 or 9 month period.
Yeah, I would like to draw you out a little bit more on Billy Graham, and maybe one way to get at that a little bit, Luke, is to talk about the question of Johnson's withdrawal. I mean, as Elliot mentioned at the outset, you know, I think most of us, including me at the time, thought that both McCarthy's showing in the New Hampshire primary, where he had, as we said earlier, exceeded expectations in getting about 40, I think, 2% of the vote. And then Bobby Kennedy's agonizing reappraisal of his non-candidacy and his entry into the race was what drove Johnson from the race. But you make a very powerful case that Johnson had been considering withdrawal for a long time before this, and probably had made the decision before it. And Billy Graham plays a role in all this because he is a confidant both to Johnson and to Nixon. He kind of endorses Nixon at the end of the day, although it's not, he, you know, protests that it's not a formal endorsement, but he does say he's going to vote for Nixon. And he has a relationship with Humphrey too, for that matter, which is pretty, is kind of extraordinary. Now, talk about Graham's relationship with all of these people and the role he plays and Johnson's sort of long decision to get out and what actually motivates LBJ.
It's a good question. You know, I think in terms of Johnson's withdrawal, which he finally made after fits and starts on March 31st, you know, I couldn't tell you, you know, there was an exact moment that Johnson knew he was going to withdraw. You know, it's a bit like, again, you know, Biden this year. Some people report, was it that letter from George Clooney? Or, you know, what was the exact moment that at least in his own mind where he knew, you know, he's going to make the decision eventually? With Johnson, you know, one of the latest things I found at the Johnson Library was that he planned to withdraw in 64 on the eve of Atlantic City. He had a handwritten statement ready to withdraw. Lady Bird had written him a 7-page memo, handwritten, on the pros and cons of staying in. I think Johnson felt, first of all, the Johnson health records are still largely restricted. I'm starting to lay hands on those now. I think Johnson was a serious heart patient after his heart attack in the 50s, much more serious. Those were hard days in the Senate Majority Leader's office. I think he was the hardest working, most successful Senate Majority Leader in modern U.S. history. And I think he paid a price for that in terms of his longevity and his life. He knew that his own father had died at a young age. He lived with this idea, true or not, that Johnson men died young. His daughters were beginning to start families, and he wanted to be around for to see the grandkids. He loved the ranch, and anyone who sort of lived in Texas or the Southwest falls in love with the land, the topography, you know, the livestock. It's all part of the lore of sort of, you know, Texas and the West. And, you know, he wanted to be around on the other end to enjoy some of that. And I think, you know, you mentioned Robert Kennedy earlier. I think Johnson believed, rightly or wrongly, that there were a certain percentage of Democrats and the elite who probably never fully accepted him as president to begin with. And so it was never a question of if he was going to bail out. It was a question of when. And I think Graham is somebody who had a front row seat to Johnson's thought process, along with very few others. I think Lady Bird is really the only one who sort of, if at any moment, knew what he was really thinking. John Connolly probably had very close instincts. He'd been with Johnson since 1937 in his congressional office. Maybe like Abe Fortas, a couple of, I think, really sort of knew his Johnson's thinking. But to your point on Graham is much more nuanced, I find, than sort of modern day religious figures. You know, Graham always considered himself to be a lifelong Democrat. Graham never endorsed, but that didn't mean he wouldn't lead you to conclude how he might be voting, you know, in an election. But he was very careful about endorsements, you know, and when he did it, you know, he would invite Nixon up to the dais at a crusade rally, but then he would invite Humphrey up to the dais. Whether or not he accepted is another factor. Graham would give the opening prayer at the Republican convention, but he did the same thing in Chicago. So Graham was much more nuanced and complex. And while we might look back today and think primarily Nixon as being the president that he was closest to, the fact is, at least in the opening months of the 68 campaign, he was closest to Johnson, I think, clearly. You know, both of them grew up in humble means. Bill Graham grew up in a dairy farm outside of Charlotte. He was from kind of the fringes of the South, like Johnson. You know, if you're a real Southerner, you don't consider where Johnson's from in Gillespie County to be the real South. High German population, much more Catholic or Lutheran than Baptist, much more open to outsiders and immigration, didn't side with the Confederacy during the Civil War. Lots of weird things going on where Johnson grew up that you can see, oh, that kind of makes sense given his unconventional political career that he had later in life. So there's lots of in common, I think, that Graham and Johnson had. And Graham was apparently is one of the few, according to the Graham Diary, this is the first book to use the Graham Diaries, that Graham had been told by Johnson he was not likely to run in 68. And I actually Graham passed that on to Richard Nixon, who said, no chance, you know, didn't believe him. And then it all made sense after March 31st. But to circle back, I think it was a long process for Johnson to decide not to run. I think I'm pretty sure that he was going to withdraw at some point. He was planning to do so at the State of the Union in January earlier that year. For whatever reason, couldn't go through with it, but finally did on March 31st.
You know, one of the things that's striking as we think about what the historical reputations of Johnson and Nixon are, while people might be willing to, grudgingly or not, give them credit, particularly Johnson for civil rights and so on, that, you know, their reputations are those of kind of Machiavellian, even cruel, manipulative, very dark figures. I think one thing about the Graham relationship that your discussion of the Graham relationship brings out, they also have, I suppose, what one could call a spiritual side, that both of them, in a very deep way, felt the need of some sort of solace. And, you know, that they both had, they had a need for Graham as sort of a confessional figure. And that it really lends a certain sort of depth to our pictures of them, which you normally don't get. By the way, I mean, I think, although I don't recall you talking about whether Graham had a relationship with George Wallace. I suppose I'd be a little bit surprised if he did. I mean, Wallace comes out as a more complicated figure. I mean, again, I'm just thinking back to my teenage years when you simply thought of him as a monster. And there's no question he played a pretty vicious kind of racial politics, but that was actually sandwiched between being a moderate on a Southern moderate, Alabama Southern moderate, sort of, for in the context And then this later period, where particularly after the assassination attempt, where he really does a kind of penance, and you know, there's this scene of him kneeling down with John Lewis to pray. I had forgotten about that if I had ever known about it. It's very striking.
Yeah, Luke, I mean, if you could talk a little bit about, I mean, all four of them, it struck me as I was reading your account. I mean, Graham, of course, rises to national fame with his crusades in the late 40s and early 50s. It's really associated in some ways with the Eisenhower revival. But the sort of evangelical Christianity that he represents in the 50s is sort of nonpartisan. It's much more about saving souls. It has much less overtones of the kind of Christian nationalism and the kind of illiberalism that you see in some of today's evangelical movement. So I wonder if you could, because as you say, I mean, Humphrey, Johnson, you know, Nixon, they all have a relationship with Billy Graham.
Yeah, I would say, and Wallace. It's brief at this time period because I'm careful because the Grahams only gave me permission to cite or talk about certain parts of the diary. So I was able to see a lot more than you see in that it's cited, you know, officially in the book. There's one mention about Graham and Wallace where Graham calls Wallace one of the greatest orators of the 20th century that I quote from the Graham diary. And after the Oregon primary, Nixon actually sends Graham down to see Wallace to kind of check on him. You know, is this a serious campaign? Is he really going to run it all the way to November? According to the Graham diary, which I cite in the book, Wallace didn't have to say anything. As soon as he saw Graham come in, he realized the political timing of his arrival on the eve of the Oregon primary. And Graham actually even expresses regret in his diary that it was a little too close to the Oregon primary. It was obvious I was coming, you know, on behalf of Nixon. But I think Graham did. I mean, you look at the Graham diary, you know, first of all, we're going to be hearing more about this in the future. This is someone who lived to age 99, who kept 50 some volumes of diaries that document verbatim contact in some cases with presidents, their families and top staff, beginning with Harry Truman in 1950, and going all the way to Barack Obama in 2016. And most of it is still heavily restricted by the Grahams to this day. And it's everything from a traditional handwritten diary to copies of personal correspondence, outgoing or incoming. It might be a White House lunch menu with something scratched on the back where the president leaned over and said this or some kind of comment. So I'd say it's kind of a hybrid diary scrapbook. And also records documenting contact with over 50 foreign heads of state. The biggest feature is the British royal family, but also lots of others. So this is really just the very tip of the iceberg of, you know, that I'm giving you for 68. And it's just a rich presidential source that's not in any presidential library or the National Archives that I found so far. So I think it really helps to explore as a vehicle these personal relationships that we've been talking about. Because as you say, he does know all of the major characters.
Could you talk a little bit about Humphrey? Johnson and Nixon are obviously kind of the two towering figures in this. And they're, the mutual respect I find fascinating, including after Nixon wins, all the way through actually to Johnson's death when they sort of suspend the inauguration festivities, I guess this is 73, in order to show respect to LBJ. I must say, you come away with a certain amount of pity from your account, a certain amount of pity for Humphrey, who was really shamefully treated by Johnson, but also thinking that Johnson was probably right in thinking that Nixon would make a better president, there's just too much stuff that's missing from his micromanaging of a campaign in a way that's ineffective, his inability to break with a guy who mistreats him very, very badly. You do get a sense this is a guy who probably was not cut out to be president. Is that too harsh, do you think?
Well, you know, I think when you read it, so the, you know, the structure of the book, it was meant to be a bit of a riff on Vivaldi's Four Seasons. So you have kind of spring, summer, fall, and the conclusion. And so these first chapters are all about people. So events defined by people. The second set of chapters is events that are defined by places, like Chicago, you know, or Miami Beach or Paris, where the negotiations were. And then, you know, the second act of that, things become more complicated. And I'm not sure they're really ever resolved by the end. But I think I admit that I was influenced by these four sides. And if they were to read only their side of the book, I think they would, it comes off as being correct or mostly correct. I mean, I really tried for a younger generation of readers for them to understand what were these people for? You know, what were their proposals and what did they stand? Who are they like as human beings? You know, I never really answered your earlier question about George Wallace, but you know, everything you say about Wallace and race is exactly right for 1962 and for 1963. But I think the difference though is all these characters are so much more nuanced and interesting to me. And Wallace gets that first taste of national politics in 1964, entering three primaries outside of the South. And when you get a taste of national politics, as Wallace did, you need to have a campaign message that's popular outside of Alabama and outside of the South. And I argue that by 68, he's really dropped all direct appeals to race. You know, I think those issues they're still there, and he certainly never recants his earlier statements about race or segregation. But I argue by 68, it's more complicated. Race is really folded into a more complex set of grievances that Wallace was utilizing, you know, in his outreach to blue collar and lower middle class voters. And I think similarly with Humphrey, he has a fascinating political philosophical journey from this really hero, a legitimate hero of civil rights in 1948 at the convention in Philadelphia. To, you know, Johnson obviously in 64 needed to be close to the liberal side of the party. This was the high tide of the civil rights era with the Civil Rights Act of 64, Voting Rights Act of 65, and so on. But then Humphrey transitions to really becoming a spokesperson for LBJ and for the administration as its policies, especially after the 66 midterms, are becoming less and less popular, like Vietnam. And Johnson seems to be running out of fresh ideas that had made him so successful in those first couple years of his presidency. And by 68, who is Hubert Humphrey is really the question that I'm asking. And I'm not sure I really have the answer. You know, he tries to return to his old sort of liberal following, but a lot of those followers have moved on to McCarthy or to Robert Kennedy. And so I think each one of these characters, regardless of where a reader finds themselves at on the political spectrum, one of the points I'm trying to get across is really like human beings, like all of us, they're much more complex and there's an evolution that takes place, and who they are really depends at what moment are you looking at them?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of thoughts, Luke, about two elements of what you've just been talking about. First, on Wallace, I agree that once he's moved out of the South, he becomes a more complicated figure. And in some sense, he goes back to his roots, really, right? As a populist, in Alabama, he was a protege of Big Jim Folsom, who was one of the populist governors of Alabama. And loses to John Patterson, you know, essentially because as he is, I don't know whether it's apocryphal or not, he's reputed to have said he was outsegged by Patterson in the primary in 1958, which is why he loses the governor's race and then is elected in 62. But, you know, you identify the three issues that he really runs on in 68. And when you look at them, law and order, busing, which is a result of school integration, and judicial overreach, you know, all of those have a racial subtext. So it's true, his rhetoric is no longer, you know, segregation today, segregation, you know, tomorrow, segregation forever, which is what he is in 62 and 63 when University of Alabama is being integrated. but it's still, you know, at best, kind of there's a dog whistle in there somewhere. I mean, you know, I think you have to say. And then on Humphrey, and maybe you could talk a little bit about this. The tragedy that strikes me is, I mean, you captured so much of it. He's lost a lot of his liberal constituency, both to Gene McCarthy and to Bobby Kennedy. He's become a cheerleader, as you say, for the administration's positions, overwhelmingly the war, despite the fact, as you document, that he had private reservations about the war in Vietnam, that basically Lyndon Johnson, when he travels to Vietnam and comes back with some reflections, Lyndon Johnson don't want to hear it. He doesn't want to hear anything from Humphrey other than cheerleading. And then when Johnson withdraws, I mean, McCarthy was never, in my view, a serious threat to win the nomination. Bobby Kennedy was, although, you know, as you point out in the book, Johnson controlled the Democratic National Committee, controlled the convention delegates, etc. But Bobby is like won, you know, several primaries. He's lost one in Oregon, but he comes out of California with a big head of steam, and then, of course, is shot and killed. Humphrey gets into the race. It's not clear what his constituency really is, you know, and he has to, on the one hand, I mean, and this is sort of very kind of timely discussion because Kamala Harris has much the same problem. He's trying to take credit as the incumbent vice president for the achievements, undoubted achievements of the Johnson administration. You tick them off: Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, Fair Housing Act. But also differentiate himself from very unpopular, you know, policy about the war. And he has trouble doing it. And Johnson doesn't help him at all. I mean, Johnson doesn't make it easy, as Eliot was suggesting. He, on the contrary, he makes it difficult for Humphrey in a lot of ways, including cutting Humphrey out starting in September from meetings of the National Security Council. So the most important national security issue that's being discussed, which is the negotiations in Vietnam, Humphrey has to find out from, you know, friends and colleagues in the administration who are cut in because Johnson's cut him out. And I mean, it's an interesting question to speculate, by the way, about who Lyndon Johnson voted for in November of 1968. He's very late to really endorse Humphrey. Finally appears at a rally with Humphrey on the eve of the election. But he's clearly on the record. You quote him telling several people that he thinks Richard Nixon will continue his policies in Vietnam with more fidelity than Hubert Humphrey. So, I mean, I don't even know, honestly, you know, I'm not sure who Lyndon Johnson voted for in November of 1968. I think it's at least an open question about whether he possibly voted for Nixon. We know Bobby Kennedy voted for Dwight Eisenhower in 1956 after spending a month on Adlai Stevenson's campaign train. So anyway, I just invite your comments on any or all of that.
No, I realize that I need to start taking notes because you give me so many great topics to talk about. I'll try to go in order there. Look, I am a blue collar kid from Ohio, first generation college grad. My rural high school had cornfields on three sides. It's politics in the South is not intrinsic to me, you know, when writing about it. So my next book is now LBJ White House Years. So I'm really going backwards in time to show. So I've given a snapshot of how I think it ended, but how did we get up to that point? How did the fundamental research question is, if Johnson was tight with the liberals in 64, how did he go 4 years later to barely being on speaking terms with them? And I think the answer is going to be more than just Vietnam. I've had to spend, you know, lately I've been going through Strom Thurmond's papers. I've been going through Richard Russell's papers in Georgia because I'm trying to understand the conservative evolution and the political shifts that are going on in the 1960s better. Your first point about civil rights and Wallace, and there's no doubt there's a dog whistle there or race is strongly implied. I would say Wallace dropped the overt appeals to race, not because that's really what he planned to do. It's because he already had those voters in 68. I don't think he needed to continue making those because you knew there wasn't a lot of ambiguity about where he stood. But even civil rights, that's complicated. you know, as I dive into the correspondence, you know, I found a letter from Senator Richard Russell to a brand new Georgia state senator, Jimmy Carter, from '67 was the letter. And he's talking about the differences between the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. And what he's saying is a lot of Southerners who are skeptical about civil rights in 57, the 57 Bill, or 64, he's like, they don't really have a problem with voting rights. He said, because Lincoln did that. That was the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments, that period. Like, they felt like that was settled long before their generation. So even when you get into like Southerners and conservatives and civil rights, even that's complicated. And so I think there's lots of room here for discussion and nuance. I think your point about Humphrey and Vice President Harris is fascinating because this is news this week and next week in between now and November. You know, the charges against Harris that she was coronated, you know, and didn't win any primaries and no one voted for, you know, Humphrey faced those same charges. I think Humphrey, like Harris, was the least disruptive option for the Democrats at a time when you could be inserted in the what was left of the campaign infrastructure. You were already one half of the ticket to begin with. And so we know where you stand. You didn't need new policies necessarily. So I think Humphrey faced those. And I think the challenge that Humphrey had in 68, as Harris has this year, and interestingly, in 68, Nixon knew what that was like running in 60. You know, as the current vice president, you know, the difficulty of anyone in that situation, and I don't think anyone's ever won in this role of running simultaneously on both continuity and change, because you're the vice president, but you're also the nominee and the de facto leader of a political party, and you continue to depend on that outgoing president, and every statement you make in a campaign, if the media is doing its job, is going to be measured against your past statements, and especially against past statements of your outgoing president for any perceived difference. In 68, some around Humphrey, including I think Averill Harriman and others, suggested that he actually resign from the vice presidency so he could be fully independent, you know, take his own positions, and really be his own man. And he couldn't do that because he felt that would be disloyal to Johnson. He felt that going back to his assignment on Senate Foreign Relations, skipping ahead of others in terms of seniority, you know, when Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson made sure he got that lucrative assignment, that everything he'd had in politics up to that point came from LBJ. And he just simply couldn't shut out that relationship at that point. He compromised by, after September 30th, not using the vice presidential seal at campaign appearances. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how Harris navigates this very awkward space, because what we learn, like in 68, on the surfaces, LBJ supports Humphrey. He's making kind of lukewarm endorsements. I'm not sure he really ever makes a full-throated endorsement. Probably the closest was that Astrodome rally, which people didn't realize in 68 didn't come until November 3rd, you know, 2 days before Election Day. And I make the argument in the book that it was really more for Johnson, intended to be a farewell from politics in front of the home crowd. I don't know how Johnson voted, and I think how someone votes doesn't necessarily indicate what they really think. I think Johnson wanted Texas to go Democratic. I think he knew in retirement he wanted his Democrat friends to stay in office. He would continue to rely on their support no matter how long of a post-presidency he would have. And I'm also very nuanced about his leaning in Nixon's direction. I'm not sure he liked Nixon. He didn't endorse Nixon, certainly. I'm not sure he favored Nixon's campaign. They weren't friends. So I'm careful. I think they were not friends. They were friendly. You know, I think Johnson leaned in Nixon's direction, not because he liked him or thought he'd be a better president. I think it's because Johnson did it because he thought it'd be better for Johnson in terms of his own legacy. So I try to be very kind of careful and nuanced about that. And I think that explains kind of his behavior. And then very quickly, Kennedy, it's a what if. You know, historians are not supposed to care about sort of what if or alternative histories. There's no doubt at the moment that he was assassinated that his campaign was surging. It was capturing that energy. It was living up to expectations that I think McCarthy never quite lived up to during his campaign. you know, you look at some of McCarthy's statements today, and it seems almost like he was running against the idea of the presidency than arguing for the presidency. It didn't seem like that's what he wrote. You know, he didn't raise money. He wasn't a backslapper. He just wasn't that kind of politician. Kennedy was. You know, he's naturally gifted in all those areas. I still think the odds would have been long for him to move into Chicago and take over, simply because this is before the McGovern Commission changes the rules. You know, the nominating process, I think, was designed much more to coronate Lyndon Johnson for another term of office than to reward an insurgent, which I think Kennedy was sort of running much more in that lane than as an establishment candidate. But, you know, who knows? This is all what if. I can barely make sense of the past. I certainly can't make sense of the present in terms of more bringing it more to today's race. But I think these are all sort of fresh things that we can talk about and still derive lessons for in 2024.
So I think, you know, the through lines from 68 to where we are today are fascinating. And I'd like to use them to pose some questions. I mean, I think Harris has a much easier task in a number of ways. First, I mean, the only Robert Kennedy out there is a certifiable lunatic now, not a serious political threat. I would say parenthetically, in your book, as well as I have to say most of the other things I've read about Robert Kennedy, he does not come out as a particularly attractive figure. And I think that's, you know, despite all the Kennedy aura, there's that. Second thing that strikes me is part of the story of Humphrey is the media elite breaking with him or being skeptical of him. And of course, the media elites have fallen all over Kamala Harris. I would like to use that to ask a question, which is, you know, one of the things that you do portray in the book is the news coverage being sort of biased at one level and clueless at another level about some of the things that are going on. I mean, I don't think the New York Times or even such you know, formidable journalists as Theodore White come out of this looking particularly good in your account. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the media coverage then. I think the other thing that your book raises, well, of course, the biggest advantage, by the way, Kamala Harris has is she's running against a malignant narcissist, and you know, Humphrey's running against an extremely formidable politician, both as a politician and substantively. But the question that I wanted to ask is, one of the things your book captures says, look, you're beginning to see this populist groundswell, which, and that is, you know, the non-college educated, then white working class, that may be less, that would be less true now, breaking with the Democratic Party, which had been their natural home. And that has a very familiar ring to it. I mean, that is to some extent our politics today, where there's this kind of populist move, and it's just beginning there, at least according to your account. So if I could draw you out on both those things. First, your view of the media, particularly the elite media, and their role in all this, at a time when the media is much more concentrated, particularly television media, but also this issue of kind of the populist surge and movement away from the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think in the media, you know, I didn't set out to make them the villain, you know, in the book. You know, as someone who's worked at a producer at C-SPAN in a previous life. And, you know, I know what it's like to cover fast-paced news stories with incomplete information, you know, where you've got to file your story before all the facts are in. And I think in 68, whether it's the coverage of the candidates or even going back at the very beginning, we haven't mentioned the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. You know, I think there's lots of room to criticize the media. And I don't attribute motive, you know, to the way that they covered events. But I think they really have an impossible job in a year like 68, where each month seems to have some shocking event that was completely, you know, unimaginable, you know, just the month before, you know, perhaps a bit like 2024. So I do think that's a challenge. You know, it's often said media write the first draft of history. And what's interesting is that when you look at this kind of six, I would say between 68 and maybe the fall of Saigon or Watergate, Nixon's resignation, the history we have today is surprisingly close to what journalists wrote 50 years ago. And I think that's interesting. You know, 50 years in terms of history is often enough time for us to have taken a fresh look, you know, for revisionism to have taken hold, for the National Archives to have released all or most of all the records, for almost all the principals and eyewitnesses to be gone, and for personal papers to be opened up. You know, not so much. It's been especially slow to have a fresh look at this time period. So the media, I would say in this case, didn't write just the first draft of history, but really the enduring draft. And it's only now that we're beginning to take a fresh look. And I think another lesson of this is if my book appeared 55 years after the 68 campaign, it's probably going to take that long to make sense of current politics. So you're just going to have to invite me back on and we'll make sense of it. But to your other points, I often say, you know, history certainly does not predict the future. It can illuminate possible paths forward. So take the Harris-Trump, you know, matchup this year. I would say one data point is the Democrats have nominated someone in the liberal wing of the party who ran as a liberal. Now, that's two different things sometimes. I would argue Obama ran mostly as a centrist two times in recent history, McGovern in 72 and Mondale in 84. And we know how those turned out. You know, even before we go to Wikipedia, 49 state landslides. The message of a candidate like that simply doesn't translate to much of middle America. Now, of course, the major difference, as you pointed out, is they were not running against Donald Trump. And they were instead running against populist incumbent Republican presidents. So very different there. I think that deals Harris some advantages while also some clear disadvantages, you know, when looking at history, if it's to be believed at all as a guide. You know, in terms of populism, you know, I think Wallace, this is something that Americans, we don't see that often, a kind of strong populist or third party candidate, certainly. And Wallace was the combination of both of those, maybe once a generation. It used to be said that 68 was one of the closest elections in U.S. history. And when you look at the popular vote, about a half million votes, that's certainly true. But, you know, we decide elections in the Electoral College, not on the popular vote. And it seems to me that since, say, Bush Gore in 2000, they've all been close. You know, and more than once, we've had the winner in the Electoral College be the loser of the popular vote. So I think for younger people, the 18, 19, 20-year-olds in my classroom, you know, they're beginning to see that whole thing, 68 being so close, they see that differently, you know, than those of us who've learned that in the history books for the past 50 years. You know, Wallace was arguably the first kind of full-bore populist, you know, attempt, anti-elite, anti-national media, you know, a lot of themes kind of from Trump's campaigns and the Trump presidency. You know, Trump, in a way, I think, is a combination of a 68 Richard Nixon or even a 60 Richard Nixon, someone kind of looking for redemption, a more kind of partisan, visceral figure who lost in his previous effort, and a Wallace running on that kind of drain the swamp, anti-elite, anti-establishment, anti-media platform. So it's interesting to me, though, that it's, you know, I've had some people tell me that the origin of Trump's campaign beginning in about 2015 was really picking up on ideas that Rick Santorum was writing about in Pennsylvania, the kind of blue collar Western PA voter, you know, who felt like they didn't have anywhere to go. And even though Trump doesn't seem to resemble them at all, that no one was talking about their issues in politics. And if you start talking about their issues, they will follow you. And I think this year, like in 68, it could possibly be those voters who, again, the Shapiro voters or the Walls voters who decide the outcome this year.
We're running out of time, Luke. We could obviously go on for hours on all of this. But as I said at the outset, I don't want to let you go without getting your take on the Anna Chenault affair and the so-called, you know, October surprise of the 1968 election. I will mention, though, we won't have time to talk about it, but I will mention that you did find in the Russian state archives that Leonid Brezhnev was sufficiently concerned about the potential election of Richard Nixon that he actually wanted to help the Humphrey campaign, although, as you point out, there is no record at all of the Humphrey campaign accepting any such help. But the classic story of the Anna Chennault affair is that Anna Chennault was the widow of General Claire Chennault. She was very active working with the so-called China lobby, very close to Chiang Kai-shek, working for Taiwan, but also very close to other governments that the United States was associated with in Southeast Asia, notably including the South Vietnamese government. She works in the Nixon campaign in 1968. She clearly has some meeting, at least one meeting with Nixon and John Mitchell. And she's in contact with Bùi Diem, the South Vietnamese ambassador to the United States. And as the Johnson administration is trying to move towards negotiations over Vietnam, which Lyndon Johnson desperately wants, as Elliot pointed out, not really to help Humphrey, but for his own legacy purposes, she is apparently caught on wiretaps that the U.S. government has of the South Vietnamese embassy communicating to the government of South Vietnam essentially to stiffen its position because it'll get a better deal from Nixon if he's elected. Johnson has at least, I think, two phone calls, or at least one, but maybe two phone calls with Everett Dirksen, the Senate minority leader, and tells him that, you know, he's caught Richard Nixon with his hand in the cookie jar and to tell the Nixon campaign to knock it off. Johnson says this is treason in his view. You've gone through all the documents. You know, what have you found on this story? I mean, it's been recounted essentially as settled historical fact, but I think you've found reasons to doubt whether it's actually a settled case or not.
Yeah, and without going through everything, you know, you set it up there beautifully. You know, this story has been on the public record for a very long time. I think I tracked it down to the first public mention was January 3rd in the St. Louis Globe Dispatch, where it kind of names names and tells the basic outline of the story that you laid out there. The Christian Science Monitor actually prepared an October pre-election story, but it was knocked down so forcefully by Walt Rostow and the LBJ White House that they largely gutted, you know, most of the details and the naming of names. So I grew up learning that this story must be true, or at least mostly true. And I think the more that I began to look into the books that have told this story very much kind of black and white, this is what happened. You know, you look at the footnotes, and so often this happens in history. A lot of history books repeat the same stories over and over again. And if you trace back the footnotes to the original source, it vanishes like a mirage in the desert. And what concerned me early on was that it didn't seem like anybody had actually talked to Anna Chennault, or Bùi Diem was still alive, you know, living in Rockville, Maryland, and from, well, I heard, good health. Tew's cousin was around, who's note taker at meetings, and was in the Chicago area. The remaining surviving members of the Paris peace talks, the U.S. delegation, were still alive. Not to mention the Humphrey campaign staffers, the Johnson staffers. It just seemed like even if what we learned was correct, why hadn't someone talked to all these people, you know, and turned every page and talked to every person who was still alive? So I think that's what got my suspicions up right from the beginning. I think if you boil the Chennault affair is complicated. You know, we could do a whole podcast just on that. But if you boil it down to its essence, what we're talking about is that Anna Chennault, this Chinese American businesswoman, passed a message to the South Vietnamese that either was approved or directed by Richard Nixon, and that the result was the South Vietnamese concluded to stay away from the peace talks, or that it changed their mind from participating in the peace talks in Paris. So when you look at those individual components, the question is, what is the message that Chennault passed? I would argue we don't know. There's no record. I mean, there's a little bit of the one of the wiretaps is she says, "Hang on, we're going to win." Well, I mean, what does that mean? And what how does that lead to some action taken or not taken by the South Vietnamese? Secondly, what's the South Vietnamese reaction? I mean, is there a record they received it? I spent almost a month in the archives in Ho Chi Minh City, and there's nothing at all about this. Now, admittedly, there's a lot of records to be opened up in that archive that are still closed. But in terms of documenting, what was the message received? And do we know that it changed their mind from participating is yet another, you know, thing we need to be concerned about. And then I think finally, the people who write about this don't point out the fact that Saigon wasn't even part of the peace talks yet. The peace talks at this time were the U.S., they were Hanoi, the NLF, the National Liberation Front, came in very late before the election. Saigon wasn't added as a fourth party until later. So they didn't even have peace talks to take part in or not take part in. They have observer status in Paris, but weren't part of the talks. And then I think finally, from a logical standpoint, if you're going to disrupt peace, you know, and today we have talks going on in Cairo or Qatar or wherever, you know, with Israel and Gaza, and this issue could again become part of this campaign. It's one of these things I'm looking at. My argument in the book is that the closer these talks came to the election day in November, the greater likelihood they could be used for political purposes, or where a peace, where some announcement could be used and occur during, according to American political timing. So if you're going to disrupt peace talks, don't you have to know what you're going to disrupt? I mean, how would Nixon or Chennault, who, as far as we know, were not privy to anything going on in Paris, how would you know what to disrupt? So where I conclude is there's no doubt she was maneuvering. That's what she did. She'd been politically active from her first political appointment was actually under the Kennedy administration. I would say she maneuvered to attract business to her company from Kennedy until Bush 41, that time period. There's no doubt, she's having meetings at the CIA headquarters. I don't have meetings at the CIA headquarters. Most Americans don't. So there must have been business to discuss or something. So there's a lot of records because of that are still closed. So my bottom line is I've talked to everybody. I've looked at every piece of evidence. I've put in every Freedom of Information Act request you can to open more evidence. And I think it doesn't add up to much of anything. But there's no doubt that there was absolutely maneuvering going on. And so I keep an open mind for when those records get opened up. And then the final point I'll make is about that treason conversation with LBJ and Dirksen. And I think you have to have listened to a lot of presidential tapes to have this perspective. And I don't mean just Johnson. I mean FDR's, Truman's, Kennedy's, Johnson's, and Nixon's 3,400 hours. An awful lot of what's on those presidential tapes, you learn sometimes very little what the president actually thinks about something or concludes about a policy option. The tapes are often used to figure out what do you think? What does the other side think in the conversation? To kind of draw them out in Socratic fashion. And Johnson had this technique, as did Nixon sometimes, but Johnson did it better than Nixon. He would have this sort of very strong reaction to something, almost as if to put the other person sort of off guard and get them to disclose or reveal something they might not otherwise reveal. So that's my interpretation, that Johnson's reaction is sort of in the heat of the moment to find out, does Everett really know anything about this more than what he's told me already? But ultimately, Johnson was such a convoluted politician. And I mean that with the highest praise. That's the highest compliment I can pay to someone in that trade. But he says a lot of things sometimes. He was his own intelligence department, counterintelligence. And he would leak and counterleak and so forth. I'm not sure what he means by that with Dirksen. And I just want to be transparent about that. I suspect he was trying to figure out what does Dirksen really know about this. And ultimately in Johnson's memoir, as in Humphrey's, they dismiss the Chennault affair, its importance, and the idea that Nixon had any direct link to whatever maneuvering she was doing.
I just want to close out by noting one thing that you did not mention, although you document in the book, Luke, which is both sides were trying to manipulate these talks. And I found shocking, as a former diplomat, someone who spent 30 years in diplomacy, the degree to which Averell Harriman and Cy Vance, abetted by George Ball, who was actually running the sort of foreign policy part of Hubert Humphrey's campaign and putatively would have been Secretary of State in a Humphrey administration, were busy going way beyond presidential instruction, making serial concessions to the North Vietnamese to try and get these negotiations moving, when it wasn't even clear that the North Vietnamese were negotiating in good faith. In fact, we now know, because of work by Pierre Asselin and other historians, that the North Vietnamese were not negotiating in good faith. So this was, in some sense, the worst kind of political malpractice. And at least in the case of Harriman, maybe not so much Vance, but you document pretty well in the case of Harriman and George Ball, this is based on their personal loathing of Richard Nixon and their determination that they wanted to do everything they could to stop him from being president, as opposed to what was best for the United States of America in these negotiations. Now, I'm sure they rationalized in their own minds that this was, you know, also good for the nation, but it was actually pretty shocking that there was a lot of manipulation going on both sides. I'm not sure I'm 100% sold that Nixon was not somehow behind the Anna-Chenault affair, but as you say, there's still a lot we don't know.
Well, yeah, and when that evidence comes out that proves otherwise, I will happily embrace it. But until then, I'll keep saying, you know, where's the evidence? But one last quick thought. I think your point, though, about the Paris peace talks is again, relevant to this year. When you have one presidential candidate who's the current vice president, how much should they know? You know, how much information should they be allowed to use directly or indirectly in the campaign trail? Nixon had this problem in 1960, faced with accusations of a missile gap, but he didn't feel like he could come out and offer a counterattack using classified information. And similarly, you know, should Vice President Harris still be attending NSC meetings? Should she have inside information to the peace talks between Israel and Gaza? Should other candidates have the same access to information? I don't know the answer. I feel like she is the vice president, so she should have more access than just, especially a minor presidential candidate. But I think this is an ambiguity in our political system and during a campaign when you have a candidate wearing more than one hat. And so I'm trying to show that degree of nuance in 68. And it's, again, something that we can ask ourselves today.
Well, our guest has been Luke Nichter, professor of history at Chapman University and author of The Year That Broke Politics. He's also the author, by the way, of The Last Brahmin, Henry Cabot Lodge and the Cold War, as well as a book on the Nixon administration's policy towards Europe, and an editor of the Nixon tapes. So he's quite expert on presidential tapes. Luke, thanks for joining us in our special convention edition of Shield of the Republic.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks, guys.